Welcome to another episode of Systematic Geekology. This is a space where we seek to create and cultivate healthy conversations between those things we geek out on and the philosophical and theological questions that often arise out of our fandoms. Like, what does it mean to be human? What makes a hero? What makes a villain? How do the stories and narratives we geek out on shape how we live in the world? We are your priest to the geeks. We aren't all ordained, but we see ourselves as mediators at the intersection of geek culture and going deeper in our faith. We don't always have to agree, but we do respect each other, and we see everyone as a beloved child of God. Everyone geeks out on something, so come geek out with us and enjoy the show.
You're listening to an Anazal Ministries podcast.
What else can we glean from studying the religious systems created by George R.R. Martin for the world of Westeros? On tonight's episode of Systematic Geekology, or in the morning, whenever you're listening to it, it's night for us. We're Systematic Geekology. We're the priests of the geeks. I'm your host, Christian Ashley. As we continue on in our theme for this year, one of them being religions, not only in the world, but also for fandoms as well. And we are going into Game of Thrones / A Song of Ice and Fire, but I could not possibly do this alone. I had to have two very handsome men at my side, the only ones capable of joining me on this journey. James Dimmel, how you doing, James? Dimmel.
That's my last
name. Goodness gracious, said your name wrong.
You got it. No, you got there. You got there at the end. I'm all right. How are you, Christian?
Okay, James. I just wish I could say names correctly. And I'm also joined tonight by Kino Kennedy. How you doing, Kino?
I'm good, sir. I'm excited for this part, too, because part one was fun. This was fun.
Oh, yes. And we should mention that we're doing this episode again, not only because it's part of our theme, but Kino and I did do this last year, and you guys wanted more. And there's plenty more to glean from the world of Westeros, so we're going to do that and more. But before that, guys, what have you guys been geeking out on?
James, you want to go first?
Yeah, I've been gaming a lot recently. So old games, too, like two-year-old games. So I recently played Sonic Frontiers, and now I'm playing a Tales game, if you're familiar with that series, Tales of Arise, which is a like massive, huge JRPG, and it's really fun, and I'm getting lost in the story, and anyways, it's great.
I'm a big Vesperia guy, so okay. I get it.
You get it.
Kino.
So I've been gaming, too. I'm still on Red Dead Redemption 2. I've played it on the Xbox, and I bought it for the PlayStation maybe a year ago, PlayStation 4 a year ago, and I finished it last year, and I'm playing it again, and it's just such a fun game. Just so much stuff you could do. That's what I've been doing.
Yeah. Well, this is totally unplanned, but I've also been on the gaming streak, also on an older game. It's that time of the year again. I'm remodding Skyrim for the 400th time and getting back into there. It's familiar, it's fun, and it just makes me feel good. So that's where we're at. Moving on to our actual theme, we're doing the Religions of Westeros Part 2. Now, last time it was Kino and I. We're adding James this time around. Since you were here, James, we discussed the old gods, the Faith of the Seven, the Drowned God, R'hllor, and the Great Shepherd. Now, I know that's a ton of stuff I just threw at you, but like, is there anything you want to touch on from those before we move on to the new stuff?
Yeah, probably nothing that you guys haven't already covered, you know, the baptism allusions and drowned God and just the fact that there's a tiny religion mentioned, I think in the books, not in the show, or if it's in the show, I've missed it, regarding the Great Shepherd. So George R. R. Martin's pulling some pretty tried and true source material and crafting it for his world. So, yeah,
it's been a while since I've watched season one, but I'm fairly certain that the blah, 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 Merez, but whatever her name is, like, I think they mentioned the religion by name that they're associated with, but it's been a while.
Yeah. Have both of you read the books?
No.
Yes.
No, I have not.
You have not. Okay. So I'm a show watcher. Christian's read the books. So we're going to bring the best of both worlds tonight.
There you go.
All right.
Yeah, that's on my list to listen to the audiobook. Because I've been also listening to audiobooks. That's the other thing. I'm sorry. I've been doing the Star Wars Old Republic. phase one.
Nice.
So I have finished. I can't remember. I can't forgive me for not remembering the titles that I've just finished, but they were good too. And they were so good. I'm gonna tell you in a second. But anyway, let's keep going.
Yeah. But James, one thing you did mention to us before when we were doing our prep for this is that you wanted to discuss the way that the Faith of the Seven went through a reformation movement, not only in the show, but like in the books as well and all that. So like, how do you think this is handled in the show and how do you think it is parallel to like real life examples?
Yeah, it's interesting to think about. So seasons 5 and 6 of the show, the High Sparrow comes on the scene and sort of throws things awry and various characters meet their end and some cruel torture because of him. But I was doing some research and he started out as like a wealthy cobbler and then gave it all, like had a debaucherous night and then like left it all and gave it up and became a septon, started this Reformation movement, preaching some pretty like hardcore quality. So like there's some definite like Francis of Assisi vibe going on with him combined with like the faith militant movement that like he brings back for like the first time in hundreds of years to Westeros and to the Faith of the Seven. And so it's like this weird amalgamation of like Franciscan spirituality and equality and like emphasis on poverty. And also at the same time, like some pretty like corrupt high Roman Catholic stuff happened that like went on at the same time in the world. Like it's kind of funny.
Yes.
Like if you study Francis's life, it's like the corruption of the church is what pushes him out. And it's with the high sparrow, he kind of comes back to it in some ways. So extremism.
Mm.
I mean, that's the bottom line, right? So he's extreme in his like living out of the faith. And that also like leads him into some extremist views regarding how people should be brought back into the faith.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point because in the series proper, like this starts happening because of an outcry within the small folk of how they're being treated, how like they've gone away from the old faith and have kind of just let debauchery rule the kingdom and they've been too silent for too long, just kind of letting the wrong people be in power. And then the church comes in and tries to solve that, but at the same time, being human themselves, messing things up along the way.
Right. Yeah. And it's also interesting to think about, you know, the whole political religious power play that like Cersei tries and it comes back to bite her.
Yes.
I mean, that's one of the scenes in the show that like is just so stark in my mind when she's doing that walk of atonement from the Sept to the Red Keep and that woman behind her yelling shame with the bell, you know. So I like have that voice in my head still. Anyways. But it's interesting like in the show in general how like religious extremism sort of rears its head in a lot of different corners. So like here, but also in the sacrifice that you see with Melisandre and you know, the Lord of Light, that religion as well. The logic of, you know, God's religion consecrating some very seemingly inhumane actions and like watching characters really struggle with that.
You know?
Yeah, no. So James points out a great aspect about the High Sparrow, because even though he's a religious figure, he still has his own political moves.
Yeah.
He has a desire for power, yep. Even though it's the perception of no power. But even his militant sparrows or whatever you want to call them, birds, they are working under his direction. And the fact is that you can't out Godfather Cersei.
Absolutely not. Yeah,
and we knew when she got back to the castle, it was on. Like she was going to get him some way, shape, form, or fashion. And that, so yeah, no, it's but the aspect of being church militant you can see how extreme it can become, that where it molds the desire of being good in aspect of your religious beliefs, but then persecuting those who really do want to try to atone and move forward. But then you're also dealing with, again, the political power and the political structure of the kingdom in of itself, that you have to compete with those. And the seven is always going to be there.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. One thing I recall Kino and I disagreed on last time was how that whole thing is wrapped up in the show with, you know, her blowing up the sept with the high, you know, the sparrow there with Marjorie and everyone. And then there's no outcry against it, in my opinion. There's no uprising against her. But for Kino, his point of view being, if I'm going to reflect it accurately, was, hey, they're all afraid of her, so why would they rise up against her? So where do you land on that?
Yeah, I feel like she probably, there were some other comprehensive moves behind the scene to like quell all of those followers. I mean, maybe simply she just like literally, they were all in one place at one time. And she literally just wiped them all out. I mean, if you saw like the equivalent of a nuclear bomb go off, right? I mean, I can't think of another analogy to it, like within the show, like one huge mega explosion, you know, plus they have the trauma of the Mad King doing that for years and years as well to people. So it's like, you know, imagine the perspective of the poor person in the crowd, like watching that blow up. It'd be easy to lose hope in that movement.
I think that's kind of where we differ, because I think that would have created martyrs.
You think so?
That would have rallied people behind that cause of, oh, this is how they're going to deal with us, a small folk, and even the people that are supposed to be in charge religiously. Oh, there's going to be payback. But I also think that was part of the show. They didn't want to focus on that too much. They just kind of wanted to have Cersei in power again. So, and yeah. There were many, many, many changes that were made that are not the best, but it's also, once again, not their fault that they had to write an ending to a show that should have had an ending about 10 years ago.
Yeah, it's George R. R. Martin's fault.
Yeah, it is.
Yes.
But Benioff and Weiss off the hook.
So, guys, you want to, anything else you want to glean from here before we move on?
I don't have anything.
All right.
Let's go to the other stuff.
Yeah.
So for the new stuff, something that Kino and I kind of touched on a little bit, but we didn't really focus on too much, was the mini face god. We go over to Braavos. We have the faceless men assigned to assassinate other people based on how they're paid. And this is kind of one of those things, as I was doing my research here, it's was kind of created due to the fact that that area of the world has people from very different regions who all have in some way, shape, or form a death god. And the people of, what did I say, Braavos? Yeah, a kind of amalgamated them together to create this mini-faced god of death that is going to try and seek out and bring death to people who they feel deserve it. So lay it on me, guys. What do you think of them?
I like them. I like the mini-faced god only because, well, I mean, obviously you've watched the show, because if you haven't, where the hell you been at? but the mini-faced god reminded me of, with the assassin piece, not the religion part, but the assassin piece of ninjas. And so that just the stealthiness and the mini-face and then trying to be deceptive, but also getting a means to an end, which... Arya does, which made it even better. Like that would be my faith only because of her. That is the only reason. I know it's coming in question later, but I don't care. That would be my faith only because of that, what she did. Oh yeah, no, I'll be down for it.
Kino is talking about our bonus question, which you can find if you become a patron or join us on Captivate. So go ahead, James.
Dangle it out there. Yeah, I'm interested. Like, I want to know what the eschatology of the mini-faced god, like, what happens after you die? Do you just go back to nothing? Do you, like, reunite with the god who is mini-faced and is death? I mean, certainly, like, there's something going on with them in terms of the power that they receive through their devotion to the mini-faced god, right? Like, the ability to change your face, quite literally, gives Arya certainly some abilities to do some things that move the plot forward. But it's interesting. Yes. I mean, the worship of death. I mean, if you think about it, like, empirically, death is one of the few bottom line common denominators in the human experience, right? We all have things in common as humans, but our lives take different paths. We look different. We have different gifts. We go different directions in our lives, but we're all gonna go end up at the same final end point, which is death. So as an object of worship, you know what I mean? What is more powerful than death if you don't have the perspective of the resurrection?
Yes. But I think you ask a really good question there. It's like, what do they believe about death? And I don't know if I saw that in my research. It's like, hey, you know, there's some Elysian field out there for someone who's killed this way, or we just all end up in this great nothingness at the end. But that's a fascinating idea of like, what do they actually think happens to you after death? They would be so willing to bring you to that point of killing you.
Right. Or like, you know, when they have a target, like, that's it. Like, there is no going around the fact that you have this target. You have to kill that person. There is no ifs, ands, or buts about it. Like, is that an act of mercy because of, you know, it's better on the other side of death or whatever, you know? I feel like, especially in the show, and who knows if George R. R. Martin will go any deeper with this in the books that remain. One would hope that we'll see them by the year 3000, but you know, you're left dangling with all these questions. I think it's part of what made Game of Thrones so tantalizing was the lore, like really, really pulls you in.
Yeah, but also remember now with the many-faced gods, for them death was a gift. That was a sacrifice, and that was a gift to the god in of itself. So to die, let me say it this way, to die in the arms of the many-faced god means that your face will be forever lived throughout, because it will be replicated and be immortalized in the walls of the many faces.
Okay. There's that.
It is a sign of respect in that idea. Yeah. So obviously one of the main themes of this group is that they are, some of them, the practitioners, commit murder as part of their job, assassinations. Like, can a religion that is tied in any way to murder be worthy of devotion?
I think it depends on what your values are.
Yeah. Cause if you value your space, your culture, your people, and you find those who are infringing on your beliefs, your God, and your area, then death is a way of honoring and preserving that which you're devoted to. But it all depends on your perspective about it. I ain't trying to be funny. I really struggle with this question because I'm like, I can understand how death is needed in certain aspects of keeping your faith going. But then the morality is that it's at what cost? Because you're killing someone else because either they don't follow, or they crossed you, or did something against your faith or your beliefs or even your values, which then don't make it justifiable in of itself. But then if you're in the position of, this is what I believe and this is what I'm going to do for my belief, then it's justifiable.
Right. The ongoing debate in ethics of teleology versus deontology, right? Mm-hmm. What's the telos end here? And if I'm going for the end, then anything goes as long as I get to the end, right? Versus what's our duty? Does the way we act matter ultimately? I could see them going either way, right? Like, if the end is to help people get to death, then certainly the means are justified. But what if death or dealing death itself is the way? I'm gonna merge universes here. What if through those practices they believe that they somehow grow closer to the many-faced God? Then it would seem justified. And I guess if your value, right? If your core value is power, or even in a weird twisted sense, like unity and death, then I could see how people could get there. Not that I agree with it. I could just see how people could get there. Understand.
Yeah, one of the things, yeah, Yeah, one of the things that kind of inspired this question in my point of view was like looking through church history. Yeah. And for those of you, there are crusades besides the ones that were fought in the Middle East. They were fought in Europe for the express purpose of bringing the gospel to pagans and heathens. And part of that was killing people and forcing them to convert to Christianity. It's like, is that ever in any way a good thing if it means that people come to faith at that point in, time? Do we have exterminations of groups like the Cathars or Cathars and working against the Gnostics and modalists and dualists and so on and so forth. Like, if heresy is allowed to abound within the church, what are we supposed to do? Are we supposed to just accept them? Do we just cut them out? Do we just, hey, you believe this, kill them all and let God sort them out? Like, what are we supposed to do in that scenario? It's not an easy answer because I don't want false beliefs to be brought into the church, but neither do I also want to be, as someone who does believe in a hell, as not a universalist at all, I don't want to be the person responsible at the end of the day for bringing death with them, even though I would argue it's really their own fault for not believing truth. It's still not, doesn't feel good of me to love that person enough. And then, well, time to go, buddy.
I think the way I handle that personally is I think evil defeats itself. Like, I think sin and evil burns itself out. And so the practice of, you know, you see in Matthew 18, you know, try and reconcile, try all the ways to reconcile, individual and group and church and whatever. But at a certain point, you just got to, you know, focus on you and let them do their thing. Don't let them, don't let them wreck your church or wreck the world. You know, stop them. But I think there's a way to do that without supplanting God's vengeance. Vengeance is mine.
Burn them all at the stake,
says the Lord.
Burn them all.
No, oh no. Oh no.
No, no. No, but in that aspect though, and I'm joking, I do value life. But the whole premise that Christian brings up is that how do you deal with dissenting arguments that might actually sway your faithful into believing something that you don't hold as true? And the only solution is to kill them. That's the only way you can kill it and burn it all. Otherwise, it will fester and it will continue to grow to where you have issues and questions to saying, is this really what we should believe or should we follow these folks? And so in that aspect, heresy has to be squashed in a way that will not bring about a dissenting point of view. As long as, I mean, again, respecting life, but I mean, what other option do you have? Because either you're going to say we can co-mingle together or no, somebody got to die.
One thing that also kind of inspired this is Old Testament law, mm-hmm. in that when a false prophets were around and, hey, they made a prophecy, I believe it's Deuteronomy 17 or 18, where they said, hey, if a prophet says something comes to pass and it doesn't, they're not a prophet of God. Your job is to stone them. That way you're not following them. You're not supposed to have all these false beliefs. You're not supposed to worship Baal or Ashtoreth or something like that, or to believe that God is equal among other gods of this nation. He is God alone. Like, and you're supposed to wipe those things out. And at the same time, I'm taught to love. How do I bring those two together is a real troubling conversation to have, but it's also one worth having because I am very glad that we don't have Gnostics running around right now in charge of the church saying, hey, you just pay 55 every month. That way I can give you this secret gnosis that only I can give you because I know more than you. I mean, the Scientology of the day, really. So obviously we're not going to solve that argument today.
If you'd like to support our show on Captivate, feel free to go to captivate.fm. And find our show, subscribe. You'll get access to any future online D&D campaigns over there. You'll get an extra bonus question for 4 to 8 times a month. You'll get extra content like that through there. You also get a one-time donation you could make to help support the show right on Captivate. So you don't get anything for the one-time donation, but if you would like to just support the show once, do a quick donation, you can do that through captivate.fm. Our overhead includes editing software, marketing, equipment, recording software, and a whole lot of other stuff. And we really appreciate everybody who can help keep the lights on.
But on to another delicate topic that's kind of was brought up with this is that part of the beliefs of the many-faced God is that life is suffering. And part of their beliefs is that if you kill someone who is suffering, it is a mercy. What are our thoughts on this and on the very real-life issues of euthanasia we experience today?
So I'm gonna deal with the first part and then the second one. The second one and the first one. So euthanasia is an idea that has to, the morality and the sacredness of life, and then dealing with the suffering of that life. How does one relieve that suffering? And for some, euthanasia is the only way to go. Because you would euthanize a dog. And they're not trying to be funny. Not trying to compare the two. But if you knew that your dog was suffering, and the veterinarian said that there's nothing else that we can do to prolong their life or give them a better quality of life, it would be cruel to keep the dog alive in knowing what we know. And the same thing could be said about someone who is dealing with cancer or whatever it is that desires to be euthanized. It is the idea of ending their suffering. However, I struggle with what Jesus said. In this life, you will go through trials and tribulations. You're going to have some issues that you're going to deal with. But take heart, for I have overcome the world. So there's hope in knowing that in my suffering, there is hope that knowing that this suffering will not last forever. But the idea that I should not suffer is a false notion that we've been incorporated to believe, when in actuality, that's a part of life in of itself.
James?
This side of the fall. This side of the fall. The issue here is with euthanasia, the debate really revolves around putting someone down, euthanizing someone, can that be an act of mercy? Can that be an act of love? That's really, I feel like, the crux of the matter. People for euthanasia would say, absolutely, I can't watch my loved one suffer or die. On the other side, you say, no, right? This is not God's will, God's plan for our lives to do that to one another. So there are trials and tribulations, which I fully agree with. And you have to find hope and endure. It gets really complicated in our culture, because I'm a pastor, so I work with people who, particularly seniors, where we have all this medical technology that can advance your life, where you suffer for a real, real, real long time now, and it is very, very, very economically draining on individuals and families, you know. And it's like, if you didn't have those options, this could have been a swift, merciful thing. But now we're sort of, so it just gets complicated.
Yeah. There may be an ultimate answer out there. It may be even an easy answer, but it doesn't feel like one.
Right.
And I'm going to take the side of no. And like, you know, using your analogy of dogs, like I set this out there. I'm not an animal hater by any stretch of the imagination. I love animals. I love dogs and cats from afar. I'd much rather be with other animals, but they're not as important as a human being.
Sure.
Only one of those was created in the image of God.
Yes.
I'm not supposed to treat that animal as, you know, with evil in my heart, you know, because I'm told to watch over creation and tend to it. So kicking a dog is not a good way of loving creation. But I don't see a parallel between the two, because one of those is engaged with a consciousness, with the ability to feel and emote and bring their awareness to other people. Sapient versus sentient.
Sure.
Like, you know, a rat is sentient. Human beings are sapient. We're aware of ourselves and able to do something about it. Kind of an easy way to put that. So as much as it pains me to see someone in that immense amount of pain, I can't in good conscience pull the plug. Now, someone else may come to a very different answer on that, but that's where I stand.
Yeah, I mean, there is a difference in between, like, pulling the plug, for me at least, and, like, actively ending someone. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
So to turn off life support, I think that it feels different. Maybe it's not, but it feels different to me.
Well,
use a specific scenario. What if someone were to hire someone just to end them?
Right.
And in this case, it would be the assassins or the many-faced god.
Right.
Go ahead, Kino.
No, so the one of the things that there is legalized euthanasia in the aspect of when you have the medical power of attorney, you tell your folks, listen, I don't want to be resuscitated. If I'm in a vegetative state, or this is where I am, don't revive me. Don't bring me back. And that's something that can help ease the suffering of those that are left behind. because to try to decide should this person live or die when you haven't had the conversation is hard. It's really hard. But when you do have those conversations, it makes it easier. And so I'm advocating that you have those conversations now. Oh. No matter what age you are, you can have this conversation now, because if something were to happen to you and you're not conscious enough to make the decision for yourself and it's left to your family, just like what James is saying, it can be extremely expensive to keep somebody on life support. Whether you have good insurance or not, it's still extremely expensive, because then that's 24-hour care. And then is that really a quality of life that someone wants to live? But then there are studies and miracles that have seen where folks have been in comas for years and woke up. So you know, it's a nuanced thing, but it should be the, I think the main issue is that euthanizing someone could be corrupted in some aspects, because it would be used to kill folks just because, which that's not what we're advocating for. But truthfully, suffering as we understand is a part of life, but then in our suffering, we find joy if we look beyond ourselves. Mm-hmm. That's the way I see it.
That's an excellent point. Like 2 years ago, my maternal grandmother passed, and she had a DNR as part of that. And we knew that going in. And that's something I did have to wrestle with. It's like, is that okay? Like, she is giving legal, what's the word I'm looking for here? I don't know, care of whatever to the people responding to her, that they don't have to bring her back. Is that ethical? Well, at one point in time, it did happen, and she was gone. She died. So I'm not 100% of where I feel on that, but I did respect her wishes at the very least. So there's that.
Yeah. It's a hard choice to make when it's your decision, even when it's your own individual decision to saying, I want to be euthanized because I want to end my suffering. You taking away those that are around you that care about you, their choice in the matter too, even though it is your life and we respect life, but the impact still is those who are left behind are going to be impacted by it one way or another.
Well, now that we're all feeling very cheery, How about we move on to something else? some good old, let's say, pillaging and other very bad things. That being the beliefs of the Dothraki, who we start seeing in season one in the very first book, and just kind of a simplification of what they believe. They have a sun and moon goddess, a sun god and a moon goddess, if I remember correctly. But their primary god seems to be one that's kind of tied in with horses, and which also ties into what we have in the first season, that the prophecy of the stallion who will mount the world, that is supposed to be the son of Khal Drogo and Daenerys, that unfortunately that prophecy didn't really pan out due to what happened with what's her name that I can't pronounce, with the multiple M's and R's. And also another fascinating thing I found out by looking at them is that they believe that if you till the earth, you are destroying the earth. And that's something that's hugely antithetical to their existence. So that's one of the big things they do. They will destroy crops and stuff like that because they view it as like a religious call to stop destroying the earth in that way. So Dothraki, guys, what can we learn from their beliefs and how they act within the world of the show?
Interesting. They sort of like...
They're just pagans. I'm sorry, James. Go on.
No, you're good. That's funny. I mean, yeah. I was thinking as you were describing them, and I was thinking about this ahead of time. The closest religious sort of mindset imagination I can compare them to would actually be Native American. Mm. I don't think Native American religions go as far as to say you can't like shape, form, or till the earth. You know, but the sense of being connected to the land, being connected to the earth, I think there is something to learn from that. I mean, in our Christian faith, the very first command that God gives is to till the land, right? To work it, to that we're connected to it. The promise, the covenant that God makes with Moses, the land is a partner in that covenant. Like, the land is what's given. You know what I mean? We're called to safeguard and really think about it. And it's sad how in our world today, at least for me, you know, many people over the last 200 years since the Industrial Revolution just take, pillage the earth. And have all these problems with pollution and all, you know, all that sort of stuff. So I'm not going to go off the climate change deep end here, but I could. but I think respect for the earth is something that we could probably take away. Probably, I think we probably can all agree that's a good thing.
Yeah, no, James, you bring up a good point of how God instituted the Mosaic Covenant in such a way that he instructed the Israelites to allow the land to have a Sabbath.
Right. Yeah. No doubt.
And the animals too. So it was a respect of everything because everything was sacred in the aspect of it was a gift given to us and we're responsible for it in that way we should be stewards of. And you're right, James, that in the last 200 years we have abused, misused, and disregarded so much that we waste a lot of food, we waste a lot of energy, yeah. We waste a lot of just because we can. Yeah. And then going to a place where the third world countries where there's not no access to clean water, there's no access to no food and those things, and to see them suffer in that aspect, and then seeing here we have an abundance, it shows the misuse and the abuse that Western worlds have done, but in the terms of the Dothraki belief system, it was a respect for the ground they walked on. It was a respect for the world that they encompassed and encountered, even though, you know, I call them pagans, but even in that aspect, they still respected what nature was to them. Mm-hmm. And they held it in high regard that there was nothing that you could do outside of that because all of it was connected, which we still are connected though.
Yeah, sure. No doubt. It's interesting too to think about, like, civilization is usually where the sin creeps in. And like even Jesus, you know, himself, when he wanted to go out to pray, he would go out to the wilderness, right? He starts his ministry, the Holy Spirit sends him back to the wilderness. You know, he returns repeatedly throughout his ministry away from the crowds, away from the commotion, away from the city to go to reconnect with God. Anyways, sorry, Christian.
Yeah.
Go for it.
No. You guys have made some pretty good points. And looking at the Dothraki themselves the obvious parallels are the Mongol hordes of the past, and seeing how they would pillage land after land, marking it as their own, and started a very vast empire that for a time took even over China and spread all the way to Hungary at one point in time. And as part of their beliefs, it was might makes right. And the Dothraki very much believe in that. Like, it's kind of a cutesy little thing to bring up for the point of, oh yeah, you know, Dothraki wedding, you know, it's considered bad taste or whatever if only 3 or 4 people die. It's like, oh, okay, that's a thing. It's like, wow, okay. But for them, like, respecting the land, it's a very fun way of looking at it. It's like you would think, oh, they're just a bunch of savages. They don't believe in what we do in high civilization, that we can till the land, make it our own, and establish cities. They're wanderers and nomads. They don't really believe in what we do. And it's a very Western idea of looking down upon such things. So I'm glad you did bring up the parallels they do have between Native Americans, First Nations people as well. But at the same time, they are also a group of rapacious pillagers who are destroying people because it's their belief to do so. That if we can take over you, it's because we're just better than you. And if you take over us, that means you're better than us. That whole might makes right argument is a very poor one, but it's also one that has propped up time and time again because it's easy to get done. Because if you're in charge, you can say, well, God favors me, or the gods favor me because, well, obviously I'm conquering you. So obviously your God or your gods or your disbelief in anything deity wise is why you're failing here.
Yeah.
All right. So moving on from there, last time we discussed R'hllor, but R'hllor kind of has an equal and opposite. I don't remember if we touched on it all, Kino, but the Great Other. So as part of the opposite of R'hllor, the Great Other is kind of associated with darkness and ice. And as far as the show is concerned, as far as the books are concerned, may even be tied in some way to the others / White Walkers. I say others. They're called others in the books primarily because it's kind of that otherness to them. They're very fae-like in that they're kind of close to humanity, but there's something else about them that's off. And we call them White Walkers pretty much in the show because I think it's because people didn't want them associated with Lost. So there's that. So when we look at someone like this, like how do we have How do our predisposed thoughts on darkness affect how we see the world? Like, for just examples, like, you know, we can't really see that well in the darkness. We're scared of the things that are out there, you know, God creating light from the darkness. Like, how do you guys look at that?
Okay, so let's take it back to a child's perspective. He was always scared of the dark. Your imagination ran wild in the dark. That toy on the wall now became a scary monster. That creak that you hear, it was something crawling underneath your bed. It was the fear of not seeing which caused one to have anxiety. And so it's literally just the unknown. And so when you're dealing with the others who only come out at night, makes it even more scarier. Yeah. So it's that idea of not being able to see with your eyes and then having to try to figure out what it is that you're hearing, perceiving, or feeling when, you know, those things could be lied to. But if you see it with your eyes, you know exactly what you're seeing. But it's just to having that fear and anxiety of the dark.
Right.
Thanks.
Yeah, I think for most people, sight is the primary way they experience the world and navigate the world. You know what I mean? I think darkness, just point blank, you can't see and anything could happen, right? Anything could come out of the darkness. You know, it's interesting. I'm thinking about all those experiences where, like, I've been the last person in my church and I'm closing out the lights. And, like, this whole
terrifying
place that I know and that I know and love and have all these good happy memories on, I turn that light off, and I'm hustling to the door. You know what I mean?
I'm there with you.
I think most people in ministry have had that at some point in time, being the last person there. You know, yep. We just worshiped God like 10 minutes ago, but no, no, the lights are off.
Yeah, it's different now, y'all. It's different.
Those are great points, both of you guys. That idea of it's a very primal fear. It's a very childish fear, I should say, of what is out there. Is that noise me just moving in my bed, or is there something underneath the bed? Is there something in the closet? I saw one clip of that scary movie my parents are watching, and I don't know the context of it, but I saw that scary monster, and now that's definitely in my room just trying to murder me in the middle of the night, you know? Yeah. It just kind of happens. And that fear of the unknown is natural. It's what we do in life, but a part of growing up is learning, hey, I don't need to be that afraid. Now, I should be aware of my surroundings, mind you, as much as possible. But being in fear of the darkness is a terrible place to be. Now, as far as, like, when it comes to scripture, I do know there are people out there who see darkness in the Christian faith as like a bad thing. Totally. I'm not one of those people. I see it as part of creation itself. Like, God gave rules for how the darkness is supposed to be out there. Like, the sun is supposed to be out this long in the world. The darkness is supposed to be out this long in the world. Both serve a purpose, a useful purpose in creation. That it is far easier for me to fall asleep when I don't have a bunch of sun lights blaring right at my eyes.
I love some shade.
It is way better for the darkness to be around. Now, I am also very grateful that I live in the present times where we have things like air conditioning and artificial lighting. So that if I need to get around, I can turn those on in the middle of the night instead of maybe getting to a candle and burning the house down or something like that. But it's part of nature. It's part of what God has designed this world. So I don't look at that too disfavorably now as I would have when I was younger.
It's interesting to think about, as you were talking and thinking about the Lord of Light, the Red Priest, that whole religion, the term that popped into my mind is light pollution. You know, like, how our artificial lights, like, disrupt nature.
Yes.
Throw animals all out of whack. Like, we're designed, like, how our screens at night, like, you know, keep it, like, disrupt our sleep cycles. Like, we're designed to be in the light, but also to rest in darkness. It's a both and. And so how it's interesting. When does light become blinding? When can light throw something out of whack?
When you no longer can see.
It's true. That's true. That moment of coming out of a movie theater, right? And on a hot summer day and getting destroyed. The blindness that comes for the good 15 seconds there. Yeah.
All right. Well, for the sake of time, I'm going to move on to our next topic. And that is one that some people may go, well, why'd you pick that? They're not really a religion. Well, kind of what they do becomes a cultic, cultic in some sense. Ooh. And that would be something Kino and I also touched on last time. That would be the Maesters. And while they may not be a religious order per se, they do have an immense devotion to chronicling the events of the world and discovering and experimenting with the natural secrets of the world. Well, what does that sound like? Sounds like Catholic monks to me, you know, with the serial numbers filed off. Now, and a part of what inspired this is actual history, and I'm going to fight something that people will say about the Dark Ages in a second, but a kind of a charge thrown against the Maesters by fans is that they hoard their knowledge and only share it with those that they feel worthy of it or to curry favor with nobility. Like, do you agree with this assessment, or do you think this correlates with how some people just viewed how the Catholic monks seem to do the same after the fall of Rome? I'll answer real quick. I see the parallels.
It's different. Yeah.
But the Dark Ages that people talk about are only dark because of our modern sensibilities.
Yep.
Knowledge was present in the world. You had monastic orders preserving it. The Arabic world was flourishing with studying science and philosophy and poetry and so on and so forth. China, same thing. Like, we just look at it from a very Western lens and go, oh no, Rome fell and all that knowledge we had is gone, and the only people were hoarding it were those dang Christians, just keeping it to themselves, forgetting the fact that if they had brought it out a bit more often than they did, it probably would have been lost. So what do you guys think?
The parallel there that I see is the hoarding of knowledge in the sense of, like, you think about the Reformation call for people to be able to read scripture in their own language.
Yes.
Right? So, like, not – I don't know if you could say that the monastic orders – in the Middle Ages, were doing that to harm people or to bolster their own power. I mean, I'm sure people do make that argument, and you can make that argument, but, you know, it, for these Maesters, it really does become a sort of prideful, vain sort of thing. And you see Samuel Tarly struggle with that, right? Like, if we had this knowledge, shouldn't we put this knowledge to use? And the Maesters that he encounters along the way seem to now go by the slogan, you know, knowledge is power, and I want to keep that power.
Yeah. Now, let's not forget that every Maester was attached to a great house.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
To teach the children the knowledge of that house and the rest of the world. That was also part of what they're responsible for. So it was a political aspect attached to it, and they wanted to keep their order going. Now, I don't know how they were funded, but obviously somebody was paying for this stuff, and whoever's paying for it, guess what? They have a say in what you do. So those great houses still kept those Maesters going, and they respected them and they loved them to a certain respect that they raised some of their kids. So and I can't remember the Maester from Snowfell. I mean, not Winterfell.
Lewin?
Maester Lewin. Yeah.
I think it's Lewin.
Yeah. So you saw him sacrifice his own life to make sure that the bloodline kept. We could survive. And so there was a political aspect, but there was a selfishness in it that these Maesters then became part of their family. But I mean, you gotta, let's also put this in perspective. When you're a part of the Grand Maester at the I can't even think of the name of
Citadel.
The capital. The what?
The Citadel, right?
Okay. Not the Citadel, but where? Anyway,
King's Landing.
King's Landing. Thank you. That whole point was we had to make sure we kept our seat and power because they funded us too. So you couldn't negate and ignore what they were trying to do. It was about self-preservation, and it's always political with Game of Thrones. It was always a motive and an issue behind it. But the whole point was the Maesters were, yes, they were preserving knowledge, and they kept the knowledge, and they hoarded knowledge. They knew a lot of things, but it was only, but it's still also a personality too. Yeah. Cause when you bring up Sam, like, Sam was like, yeah, no, we should know about this. Like, this is not good. We need to know that, listen, the winter is coming. And so it all depends on how you look at it, but it overall, to me, they had to maintain their political aspect of themselves because that was the only way they could survive.
Yeah. I think the point you made earlier, James, about, you know, how the hoarding of knowledge did end up becoming something evil in a sense for the monastic orders of the day, for the Catholic Church, was, well, we would like to speak our own language in a church service or to be able to read in our common tongue. Well, you can't. Why? Well, because of tradition and because it controls you a little better if we do it this way. Yep. And I'm a fan of the Catholic Church, don't get me wrong. But I'm also a big fan of the fact that Martin Luther stood up and said, hey, we got some things that need changing. So without him, and hey, one of the greatest things, and I would even argue one of the worst things that ever happened in the world, is that the Bible is written in the common tongue and that people can access it. But that means anyone can access it. And that was one of the fears they had. But you have people starting cults based off of the Bible. Well, that was happening anyways. I would much rather live in a universe where I can just, hey, I have that right next to my book stand right here. So I can just pick it up whenever I want to. And if I don't pick it up, well, that's on me, versus you're keeping it away from me. Well, now I don't really have an excuse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, that's guys, is there anything else you want to add before we wrap things up?
I feel like we need to teach a course using different religions in Game of Thrones to illustrate different religious doctrines.
That would be fun.
I'm sure someone saw it. I'm sure there's like a layman's like religion of Game of Thrones 101 out there.
Yeah.
All right, guys, do you have any recommendations for the audience?
Yes, I found the book I'm listening. I'm currently listening to on audiobook Star Wars The High Republic. What's this thing called? Into the Darkness. Into the Dark.
Okay.
So this takes place 250 years before The Phantom Menace. And this is where they're exploring the Outer Rim and trying to map the Outer Realms. So, that's my recommendation.
I'll also recommend a book series that I read in January that I really liked. It's by an author. Her name's V.E. Schwab, and it's the Shades of Darkness trilogy. So the first one's called The Darker Shade of Magic, and I absolutely loved that. So all three, I couldn't put them down. I read them in like a week.
I mentioned Skyrim earlier, but like if you want a fun religious system that doesn't make sense but also makes sense, I might recommend that you guys, if you're curious, look up how the religious system of the Elder Scrolls universe works. There's a lot in there that is contradictory, but also people believe in it. Because people believe in it, it happens. It's a very fun mythos to create, but also one that I feel like I have to have a PhD to actually understand everything in. But it's worth the time. Mm-hmm. So guys, thank you for listening today. We have a bonus question after this for our Patreon and Captivate listeners. Please just leave a 5-star review in your podcasting platform of choice. Join us on YouTube as well. Subscribe to our channel there. We're trying to get more subscribers there to get more content. But remember, guys, we are all a chosen people, a geekdom of priests.
Hello, friends. Are you enjoying what you're hearing from Systematic Ecology today in your earbuds, or whether it's on YouTube, or whether you're in traffic, or whether you're at work? Well, there's another way that you can stay engaged with us at Systematic Ecology, and that's on our Instagram account. Yes, hop over to Instagram, follow. We'll follow back, we promise. We post lots of fun stuff over there, whether they're updates on new podcasts that are coming out or getting ready to come out, or whether they're memes, or we're sharing what other of our friends are up to out in the world. Sometimes we go live at events, whether we're at a Comic-Con or whether we are just hanging out with friends on the back porch grilling out. You can follow us there. We also have videos and reels, like what's in Will's pull box from his local comic book store. He shares what he's reading in the world of comics. And then Christian is going to do some reviews of Spider-Man comics called Spidey Swing Buys. That's going to be fun. And then there's non-canon stuff. Non-canon? What? Yeah, Joshua's going to be reviewing one intellectual property from outside of the canon of his favorite fandoms, or a piece of literature that's a part of the biblical extra canonical material. Man, that sounds like fun. But yeah, Instagram is one of my favorite social media outlets, and I love to engage with friends and family over there. And so we hope that you can engage with us there.
Hi, my name is TJ, and I'm here to tell you about the Onizon Ministry Podcast Network. We have a bunch of shows on AMP. You can follow the entire network in a single feed on Spotify at Anazal Ministry Podcasts or on the network page on Apple Podcasts. Some of the ones we're running right now are The Homily, which is Pastor Will's homily messages from Holy Trinity Lutheran Church in Chapel Hill. We have The Whole Church Podcast, which one of my favorites. It's where myself and Joshua, we interview leaders from different denominations and backgrounds to work for a full church unity, Big C. We have My Seminary Life by Brandon Knight, former host on Systematic Ecology. He discusses his experience at seminary and discusses seminary topics so anyone can access the knowledge, which is kind of cool. It's like the book, everything you learn at business school and then everything you don't learn at business school. That's great. We have Let Nothing Move You by Christian Ashley. He goes through the Bible, kind of like it's a Bible study, to explain the biblical narrative through his perspective and what he's learned. Dummy for Theology, which is Joshua's show. He discusses various theological topics in an attempt to show every side of big discussions. That leaves you with more questions than answers, which everyone loves a lot. It's kind of a continuation of a series that we did on Whole Church, but it's really good. It's really fun. We have The Bible After Hours, where the foul-mouthed preacher goes through the Bible from a progressive view to challenge the status quo of the modern church. I love that one. If you're from a more conservative background, that one I find will probably be the most helpful for you. Definitely check that out. And we have The Clydes. Taylor and Elizabeth Clyde go through weekly discussions in a devotional, conversational method to help us get closer to one another and God. That's just a little review of what we do in AMP and all of our other shows. So check that out, get subscribed, and just start getting all that free content, you know?